Okay, so let me start by saying that as it pertains to this talk, in this decade we anticipate two major and interrelated revolutions in astrophysics. The first one is what I'll call systematic time domain astrophysics. And what I mean by that is continuous mapping of the sky to search for and characterize variable sources and transient phenomena. And this revolution is enabled by new wide-field telescopes, both in the visible part of the spectrum and soon in the radio, as well as by advances in computational capabilities that allow us to process and understand large data sets. The second revolution has the buzzword multi-messenger astrophysics. And what I mean by that is observations of astronomical sources and understanding of their underlying physics using not only the traditional electromagnetic part of the spectrum, but actually expanding outside of the EM part into gravitational wave, neutrino, cosmic ray detections. And this revolution is enabled by new non-EM facilities that are coming online now and in the next few years that will actually be sensitive enough to detect sources in the local universe. So out to tens and maybe hundreds of megaparsecs, where we actually expect to see the first detections of gravitational waves, of neutrinos, and cosmic rays. So the focus of our workshop is this interface between gravitational wave and electromagnetic studies. And it's centered on the most likely sources to be detected in gravitational waves in the near future, which are the coalescence of binaries composed of neutron stars and black holes. So that will be the focus of my talk today, and that's what we've been discussing here at KITP for the last 2 months, and we have another month or so to go in this program. So as Lars mentioned, Duncan Brown gave a talk a few weeks ago focusing on how the gravitational wave detections will be made, what are the challenges there, and what I want to do today is talk about the electromagnetic part of this story. Okay, so there are several topics that I want to cover, so I'll leave this outline up here for the remainder of the talk. So the first one is, why do we actually want to do the electromagnetic observations? What do we learn from these observations? As I'll show you, this is quite a challenge, and so there better be a payoff for all of this hard work. I'll give you a brief overview of what facilities are actually exist now or are coming online in the next few years at the same time that the gravitational wave detectors are coming online, spanning all the way from gamma rays to radio, which is the approach we will probably have to take in order to detect the counterparts. So I'll talk about radio all the way to gamma ray facilities and what their capabilities are as they pertain to this problem of detecting counterparts. And then I'll describe the rich set of phenomena that we anticipate from these actual mergers. Relativistic jets, outflows, a variety of things that will actually produce the electromagnetic signal. Okay, so what kind or what type of EM emission do we actually anticipate? And in this context, I'll focus for a brief part of the talk, 5 minutes or so, on one particular type of counterpart, so-called short-duration gamma-ray bursts, and I'll come back and define what these are. I'll refer to them as short GRBs, where we think that this is actually a counterpart of one of these neutron star binary mergers that we've actually already seen before any gravitational wave detections have been made. And I'll describe to you why we think these are counterparts of these binaries. And what I'll do at the end is I'll take these 3 points. What are our capabilities in the next decade? What type of emission we expect? And what we have learned from observations of short GRBs? And bring all of this together to talk about the challenges and the approaches for our search strategies for EM counterpart. Okay, so I'll talk about search strategies. And hopefully by that point, you will appreciate that this is a worthwhile endeavor, but that it will take a very large concerted effort from a large community of people. Okay, so from the point of view of electromagnetic counterparts, what we care about from the gravitational wave side is, you know, the gravitational wave detections will be made independent of electromagnetic counterparts. But for that interface to enable these observations, we care about three primary things, which are, you know, how many events are going to be detected, what are those events, to what distance they're going to be detected, and how well will they be localized in the sky so that we can go and search for the counterparts. So as I mentioned, the expected sources to be detected by advanced LIGO are binaries composed of neutron stars and black holes. So let me just give you the numbers for the neutron star binaries. Okay, so what we expect here is that LIGO will detect these to a typical distance of about 200 megaparsecs. Okay, so that's a redshift of about 0.05. So we're really talking about the nearby universe. We're not going after things during the era of reionization or something like that. The rate that's predicted is somewhere between 0.4 and 400 per year within this volume. Okay, so that's a huge range. The favored number is about 40. So that's a number that you can keep in mind. The reason this uncertainty is so large is because it's based on neutron star binaries in the Milky Way, their merger time scale distribution, and there are only 8 or 10 systems. And it's also based on what's called population synthesis models. This is where people take a large population of binaries and evolve them on a computer to try to see how many of them will merge as a function of time. And so, you know, that gives us this large range. And one of the things that advanced LIGO will do is actually tell us what that rate is. Okay, and the last thing we care about, is the localization. So how well will advanced LIGO localize sources in the sky? And that number is somewhere between 10 and maybe 10 to the 3 square degrees. Where in the early days, we expect perhaps thousands of square degrees. And over time, as more facilities are added to the network of gravitational wave detectors, it might be down to about 10 square degrees. But to remind you, the moon, the diameter of the moon is half a degree. Okay, so we're talking about enormous areas on the sky.
This is LIGO by itself or LIGO plus Virgo?
This is LIGO plus Virgo. LIGO by itself, actually, because there are only two detectors, can only give a very wide ring on the sky. And I think that will be almost impossible to follow up.
What about the detector and
Indy? That will improve on things even further. And so I think once we get to the combination of the detector in India plus in Japan, we're talking maybe 10 square degrees. It also, of course, depends on the signal-to-noise ratio of the detection. And so I think it's going to be harder to go better than this. And this will be a more typical number. Okay, so this is a large challenge, and this is why I said that the advancements in time domain astrophysics, in wide field imaging of the sky, is critical, because we will have to image these very large areas on the sky. Okay, so these are the numbers for our neutron star and neutron stars. I don't want to give specific numbers for neutron star black hole systems, except to say that they will be detected to larger distances, because the total mass is larger. The rate is highly uncertain. We've never seen a neutron star black hole binary in the Milky Way. To a large extent, we don't even know if they exist. But expectations are that the rate will be subdominant to neutron star, neutron stars. And the detection, the area on the sky will probably be similar. Another complication is that if the black hole is fairly massive, greater than 7 or 10 solar masses, and it's not spinning, the disruption of the neutron star will actually occur inside the innermost stable circular orbit, meaning that there will be probably no long-lasting electromagnetic counterpart for this process. Okay, so that's another complication. So this is a fairly big question mark at the moment. And finally, black hole binaries. Those are fantastic objects. Again, we don't know if they exist. We suspect that they should, but we've never seen one. They will be detected perhaps out to about a gigaparsec, so a significantly larger volume, and the rate, the detected rate, could actually dominate over any of the other systems. But there's no matter here, and so we don't expect EM counterparts. So from the point of view of our searches, we really focus on these systems, the neutron star binaries. We know they exist. The rate is uncertain, but if LIGO detects any of them, there is hope of detecting their EM counterparts. Okay, so let's get to the first point. What do we learn from the electromagnetic detections? Just to remind you what we get from the gravitational waves, very briefly, we get some sense of the masses, or some combination of the masses. So this will tell us whether our system is a neutron star, or black hole system. We, of course, will know the rate. So we'll finally measure what the event rates are for these different types of binaries. We can gain some information on spin and precession of the binary and its components. And in some rare events, we might even be able to do things like measure the equations of state of a neutron star. Okay, this is not going to be a typical measurement, but maybe for a few events in the first decade. So these are critical parameters that tell us about the system itself. And you can say, well, what does the electromagnetic part add? Well, I think it adds several key ingredients. The first one is, and you can see it from here, the first one is a precise localization. And this is critical for several reasons. First, if we can precisely localize the source, and by precisely I mean to better than an arc second or a few arc seconds, we can actually tell which galaxy it came from, and we can measure the distance to the object. Measuring the distance directly from gravitational waves is highly challenging, but if we can get the distance from here, that sets the energy scale of the whole event and will give us some critical insight into this process. The other thing that a precise localization gives us is what I'll call the astrophysical context. And what I mean by this is, what type of galaxy did it come from? Where did it come from inside the galaxy? Was the source associated with star formation activity? Was it associated with the halo of the galaxy, with a globular cluster? Perhaps it's far off, away from a galaxy, and did not occur inside the galaxy at all. And so this astrophysical context will tell us quite a lot about the progenitors. Right? So even if we know from here that the progenitor was a neutron star binary, the astrophysical context will tell us, how did that binary form? Right? Where did the merger take place, and what does it tell us about the formation of the system? We can also learn about the merger dynamics. And what I mean by this is, how much material was ejected in the merger, what kind of velocities, what kind of energies for forming a relativistic jet versus a non-relativistic spherical outflow. Okay, so this is mass ejected. And potentially, once we understand things a little bit better than our current state, we might be able to tell based on the absence of an electromagnetic counterpart, potentially, versus if we looked at a system that's neutron star black hole versus black hole black hole. Independent of what we can gain from the gravitational wave emission. But of course, that means we really need to understand things very well so that if we don't see something, we know that it's not because our searches were inefficient, but because there's really no emission. Okay. So I think the electromagnetic part adds quite a lot of richness to the gravitational wave information, and it's really the combination of these two that will be really powerful. Okay, so this is great, but of course the challenge is that we have to find this counterpart over this very large area, and potentially over short timescales. Okay, and as I mentioned, this is why the wide field capabilities are important. Okay, so I covered this, and let me move on to these facilities. Okay, so I want to discuss a range of facilities across the EM spectrum, and there are a few parameters that I want to give you that are relevant for this question. Okay, so I'll give you the wavelength, field of view. Okay, so this is the area on the sky that one of these detectors can see at any instantaneous moment in time. The localization capability. Remember that an important part of this is that we need to get the localizations down from hundreds of square degrees to an arc second to make these kind of studies. And finally, what I'll call the ease of detection, or I guess the difficulty of detection, if we're looking at the glass, half empty, which has to do with primarily with what we already know about transient sources in this part of the electromagnetic spectrum. Right, imagine that we have a part of the electromagnetic spectrum where this is going to be buried in hundreds or thousands of other potential variable and transient sources. Of course, that's going to be much more difficult in hundreds of square degrees to find a counterpart in a unique way. Okay, so let's start in gamma rays. So for this purpose, astronomers usually refer to gamma rays as greater than 10 keV radiation. The field of view of gamma ray satellites is enormous. It's somewhere between 10 to 100% of the sky. Okay, so some of these facilities are capable of seeing the entire sky essentially all the time. The localization capabilities range quite a lot, anywhere from a few arc minutes to of order 10 degrees radius. And 10 degrees radius is not actually much better than this, right? So some of these actually may detect the counterpart, but will not improve the localization. The ease of detection, though, I'll put it here as easy in the sense that the gamma ray sky is relatively dark. There's a few sources in the sky that produce gamma ray emission, including transient sources, and so it's relatively easy to pick them out once they occur. I can give you some names here. So these are facilities like the SWIFT satellite or Fermi, which are operating right now. Okay, then we have X-rays. So X-rays, 0.1 to 10 keV. And here there's a challenge, because right now there are no wide field X-ray instruments available. Typical fields of view are less than 1 square degree. So these are things like Chandra or XMM-Newton. And so this is, of course, a challenge if we want to search hundreds of square degrees. They're capable of providing localizations of somewhere between 1 and a few arc seconds. Okay, so that's already better than what we can do in gamma rays. And here I'll put medium, because, the sky background in X-rays is not so severe, and it's a little bit better characterized than other parts of the spectrum. Okay, so this brings us to optical, which is about 0.3 to 1 micron. And here is where there's been a lot of development in the last few years, so that there are now telescopes with imagers that have fields of about 10 square degrees. Presently, it's 1 to 2 meter telescopes. In the very near future, we'll have the first 4 meter telescope with such a wide imager. And then around the same time that we expect Advanced LIGO to really kick into operations, we will have the big gorilla in the room, the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, which is an 8 meter with a 10 square degree field of view. So this will be the ultimate facility, in a sense, for doing follow-up. Here, the positional capability is excellent, better than of order a tenth of an arc second. So if we really want to not only understand the distance scale by associating with a galaxy, but actually address the question of where within the galaxy did the merger take place, the optical is a fantastic place to do this. But this is where it gets difficult. The background of other unrelated sources is only partially known. So the background is not well characterized. Especially on the timescales and to the levels of brightness that we anticipate for the counterparts. Okay, so right now, it's a bit of a question mark of what kind of background we have to contend with to find these counterparts. Okay, the near infrared, which is the next part, is about 1 to 3 microns. And this might seem like I'm splitting hairs. You know, here I'm talking about huge ranges. Why did I do 0.3 to 1 and 1 to 3? The reason is that the technology changes from this part of the spectrum to this one. Here we can use CCDs. CCDs are relatively cheap. It's easy to build wide field imager. In the infrared, we have to use different detector technologies, very expensive. And so to build something like this could cost tens or even $100 million. And so there are no real wide field infrared telescopes, the largest ones are about 1 degree squared. Okay. And this will come into play later on when I'll talk about potential counterparts, why this could be a problem. Again, very accurate positions, and we're in the same situation here as we were in the optical. The backgrounds are not really well understood. Not only that, the sky background, just the brightness of the sky in infrared and its variability is much more problematic than it is in the optical. So just the mere detection, not only detecting something and identifying it among a sea of other things, is already more difficult. Okay, I'll split the radio into two parts, the kind of gigahertz frequency range. So this is about centimeter wavelength. Right now, all of the existing facilities have small fields, less than 1 square degree. So these are facilities like the VLA. They can provide localizations of anywhere between 1 arc second and 1 arc minute. And here the situation is even worse than in the optical. We essentially have no information on what is the range of variability and of transient sources at the flux levels that we're talking about that will be required for detection. So this is just one big question mark of whether this is going to be straightforward or extremely difficult. And finally, we have the radio kind of 10 to 100 megahertz range. So this may be meter wavelength. I should mention here that there are facilities that are coming online that will have fields of potentially about 10 square degrees. So this could become quite interesting in the next few years. The very low frequency radio, there are wide field of view facilities. In fact, it's possible to construct essentially an all sky facility. So this is very similar to the gamma rays. The field of view can be essentially all sky, but with very poor resolution, so the localization accuracy can be of order an arc minute or even greater. So this will be difficult again in terms of improving the positions to the scale that we need. And here also the backgrounds are just not understood. I should also mention that another issue in the radio, because the resolution is not so high, there's a problem called source confusion, which is as you take images that are deeper and deeper, you start seeing sources overlapping on the sky. And at some point, there is a floor of emission from unresolved sources that prevents deeper observation. So if we want to find a very faint source in the radio, we might have a problem due to this confusion limit.
For the very last one, SKA probably, right?
Oh, so here we're talking about, in the presence, we're talking about things like LOFAR. Okay. Or MWA, there are quite a few facilities. In fact, most of these are actually geared to doing 21 centimeter reionization studies, which is why they go to low frequency to look at redshifted 21 centimeter radiation, but they'll also have very wide fields. Okay, and SKA down the road. Okay, so there's quite a range of facilities, but you can see that they have very different capabilities. Okay, I also want to point out another issue, which is that there's a fundamental difference between the gamma rays and the very low frequency radio, where we essentially have all sky coverage, which means that we can detect sources simultaneously with advanced LIGO and with one of these facilities, right? Because they essentially see the whole sky all the time. Whereas facilities in the X-rays, optical, infrared, and high frequency radio have, even though their fields of view are relatively large, they're not large enough that we'll have simultaneous detections. So here the mode of operation is different. We get an alert from LIGO saying there's a source in this part of the sky, and now we have to use these facilities for follow-up. Now, luckily, it turns out that of the counterparts that we anticipate, the ones that are expected to actually be simultaneous in time with the gravitational waves are in the gamma rays and potentially at low frequency radio. So nature has been kind to us in this sense. Okay, so this brings us to the third point. So what type of emission do we expect? Okay, so as I mentioned, this quite a rich set of predictions here, and this is part of what we've been doing over the past 2 months is fleshing out some of these ideas. And so let me give you kind of a sketch of what we're looking at. Okay, so pre-merger, We have this very nice, simple system. We have a pair of neutron stars orbiting each other. And then as they merge, all hell breaks loose. Okay, so what do we expect to happen? Well, we presumably will have formation of a black hole here, although this is not certain that this will happen in every single case. It's possible that if the two neutron stars have masses that are at the low end, they will merge to form a more massive neutron star rather than a black hole. But for now, I'll take the black hole case. We expect to have some debris that's left behind in an accretion disk. And that material will accrete onto the black hole, and through the magic of astrophysics, will produce a relativistic jet. Okay, so we have a jet here. The opening angle is fairly small. And then we can have internal dissipation of energy within the jet. So we can have, for example, collisions or dissipation of magnetic fields that may produce gamma rays. Okay, so this is our relativistic jet. And then in addition, this jet will punch out into the local environment and interact with whatever matter is surrounding the binary system and produce a shock. So we'll have shock here against the interstellar medium. And we expect here to see X-rays, optical radio. So already just from this relativistic jet, we get quite a range of phenomena. Now, not all the material in the merger will actually end up in the black hole or in the accretion disk. Some of it will be ejected from the system. So we will have some outflows of matter, either ejected dynamically or from a wind that emanates from this disk. So we have here a dynamical ejecta plus wind. And this dynamical ejecta will also interact with the surrounding medium. So we have this interstellar medium over here. And it will produce a shock. And what we expect to see here is radio emission primarily. OK, and then finally, remember that what we're merging here are two neutron stars. And so this ejected material is going to be quite neutron rich. And when that ejecta expands, the material can decompress and produce R-process radioactive elements. And so we'll have some R-process here. And those elements will decay and produce UV or optical or infrared emission. Okay. All right, so in principle, in this scenario, we can get everything from radio to gamma rays. Okay, so let's look at some of these ideas in more detail and see how they relate to each other. So let me start with the relativistic jet. So as I mentioned here, we expect from internal dissipation, we expect gamma rays. And the time scale for this is essentially simultaneous with the merger. And then we also expect through interaction with the local ambient medium to see X-ray optical radio. And the time scale here is anywhere from a few minutes to days. Okay, so there's some delay here compared to the gamma ray emission.
You know, you might want to say what the orbital frequency is at merger, just to give people some time scales.
Oh, I wish I could remember that number offhand. Do you have it at the?
Kilohertz, nearly a kilohertz.
Okay, kilohertz, yeah.
Millisecond, yeah.
Okay.
Could you also say what the duration of the detectable gravitational wave?
So with advanced LIGO, I think it's going to be minutes, several minutes, as the source evolves through the frequency range of advanced LIGO. With facilities that are envisioned in the future, it could be longer than that if they span a wider frequency range. Okay, so what do we actually know about this component? So here we have some data and we have numerical simulations that suggest the following parameter. So we have an energy scale of about 10 to the 50 erg. Remember, this is a relativistic jet. The Lorentz factor is of order, or maybe even greater than 100. And therefore, the amount of mass that's actually ejected in the jet is minuscule. 10 to the minus 5 solar masses. So it has to be a fairly clean environment for it to attain these high relativistic velocities. And the opening angle is of order 10 degrees. OK, so there are two other important issues here. One is that both of these types of emission will be beamed. Right? So if we have an observer looking at the system from this direction versus from up here, in one case, they will see this jet. They will see all this phenomenology. And in the other case, they will not see any of it. Okay? And in fact, with this kind of opening angle, the majority of time, the observer will be away from the opening angle of the jet. So it's only maybe one time out of 50 we'll be lucky enough to be along the sightline of the jet. So there is beaming. That's one issue. Okay, and the gamma emission is more strongly beamed than the optical and X-ray and radio. So that's one issue. The other interesting part that I want to compare and contrast for all of these is that the first part of the emission, the gamma rays, is independent of the environment. This is some sort of an internal process in this relativistic jet. It doesn't matter if the jet is going into vacuum or into a very dense medium. So the gamma rays are independent of environment. Whereas this second component, which I'll call the afterglow, of course, depends on the density of the environment. So if the jet slams into a very dense medium, it will be bright. If it goes into vacuum, it will be undetectable.
You expect all coalescences to produce a jet?
Not necessarily. No, and we don't know really a priori what that fraction is. It's possible that if through some process here, this environment gets polluted by too many baryons, it will essentially choke this relativistic jet. We really don't know. Okay, so the afterglow depends on the environment. Okay, so that's the relativistic jet. The next part is this neutron-rich ejecta. So remember, we have this neutron-rich material. It will expand as it flows out. We'll produce R process elements. And those elements can then radioactively decay. So this is very similar to what happens in a supernova explosion, where the visible light from a supernova is dominated by photons that were produced by the radioactive decay of nickel. Only here, it's not nickel. It's a range of R process elements. So we have this neutron-rich ejecta. And so here we expect UV, optical, or infrared emission. The amount of ejected mass, this is now coming purely from simulations. We've never actually seen this in real life. Is somewhere of order 0.01 solar masses, which will give a luminosity that's about 1,000 times the luminosity of a nova. Okay, so this is why people have been calling this a kilonova. Okay, so that's the term I'll use. And the time scale is of order a day. Okay, so this is going to be a fairly short-lived counterpart that's potentially reasonably bright, but not as bright as a supernova. Okay, then we have the dynamical ejecta. So regardless of...
Just going back to that, do we have evidence for seeing such events in any of the surveys? I know that there are many surveys, but...
No, there's nothing convincing that stands out as being this type of process. Sure. I'll come back a little bit later to why that might be. Yeah.
Are there estimates for how often these or any type of mergers take place generally?
So I gave the rates initially. It was within the 200 megaparsec volume. It was something between 0.4 and 400 per year. People have actually used this idea to constrain the rate. Because you can ask how much, what's the mass of R process elements in the galaxy? If you produce this much from each one of these mergers, you can add it all up and put some upper bound on the rate, and it's not inconsistent with the wide range that's available. Okay, so this ejecta will also interact with the interstellar medium, and so we have the dynamical ejecta plus wind. Oh, I should also mention two important points here. This is more or less an isotropic emission source. okay, unlike the relativistic jet, and it's independent of the environment. And this is why this is a very attractive counterpart, potentially, because we can see it from any viewing angle, and it doesn't depend on where the merger really takes place. Okay, so the dynamical ejecta plus wind, this is similar to the relativistic jet, it's just this interaction of this outflow with the environment, only here it's not relativistic, it's there's more mass ejected. So again, from simulations, we're talking about ejecta masses of 0.01 to maybe 0.1 solar masses, velocities of about 15% the speed of light. Okay, so not that impressive for people that work on gamma ray bursts. And so the energy here, the kinetic energy is of order 10 to the 51 Ohms. So the kinetic energy is actually similar to the kinetic energy in a supernova explosion. And what we expect this to produce is radio emission. And the time scale here is anywhere between months to decades after the merger. Okay, and the reason is that this outflow has to be decelerated by the interaction with the medium in order for it to radiate. The way it decelerates is by sweeping up a mass that's equivalent to its own mass. And so if the density is very low in the environment, it will take years and decades to sweep up that amount of mass. If it's a denser environment, it will be a shorter period of time. This is expected to be isotropic, so that's good. But this, of course, depends on the environment. Okay. A last possible component that I didn't draw here, an electromagnetic component, could happen during the merger process itself. So we can envision a wide range of processes, for example, interaction of the magnetospheres of the two neutron stars, or the cracking of the neutron star crust, or a variety of exotic processes that could produce a very brief release of energy. And if we make the assumption that that release of energy then produces electromagnetic radiation, we could see a signal that's simultaneous with the merger itself. From first principles, it's essentially impossible to predict, one, how much energy will be produced, and two, what part of the electromagnetic spectrum, if any, it will actually come out in. So this could produce radio emission or gamma emission or nothing at all. So I'm not going to really talk about this, but there's quite a lot of literature on this topic. Okay, so you can see from all of this that we anticipate a range of emission processes. Some of them are isotropic, some of them are beamed, some of them are dependent on the environment, some are independent, some are robust, some are more speculative. And they're in different parts of the spectrum, some of which are more easy to detect and some are more challenging. Okay, and so what essentially this argues is that there is no real one ideal counterpart that we want to look for, and that essentially means that our search strategy will have to span the entire electromagnetic spectrum and on timescales all the way from simultaneous with the merger to maybe decades after to identify the counterparts. I should also mention that except for this relativistic jet, which may or may not exist, and which produces this burst of gamma rays, we haven't seen any of these predicted counterparts in reality, right? They're all speculative. We've seen this process. This is what's called a gamma ray burst. So that's what I want to talk about next for a few minutes. Okay, so let's talk about GRBs. Okay, so this is actually kind of interesting. So gamma ray bursts, the actual story of gamma ray bursts, in many ways mimics what we're trying to do here. They were discovered accidentally in the 1960s. For the first 30 years, there was very little information about what produced them, because the positional accuracy, the positions on the sky were of this of a scale of tens or hundreds of square degrees, and it was impossible to find a counterpart that gave a better, more accurate position. Until the late 1990s, when they were finally localized precisely, and that opened up a whole field essentially. Because what this gave us is distances, energy scale, understanding of what galaxies they came from, what the progenitors are, et cetera. So we, you know, what we did 10 years ago or 15 years ago with gamma ray bursts is what we're going to try to be doing in the next decade with gravitational wave sources.
So we're hoping it doesn't take 30 years.
No, I think we're smarter than that. On the other hand, you know, the detection rate of gravitational wave sources is very low. Yeah, but yeah. Okay, so there are two types of gamma ray bursts. If we draw a distribution of the duration, we find that it's bimodal. So it looks something like this. This is 0.1 second. This is 10 seconds. This is about 1 second. Okay, so we call these ones short GRBs, and these ones are long GRBs. Okay, make sense? Okay, so long GRBs have durations anywhere between about 1 second and 1,000 seconds. We've seen them associated with supernova explosions. They only occur in star-forming galaxies. The environments around them are fairly dense. And so all of this together points to the progenitors of these objects being core collapse of massive stars. Okay. The rate is lower than supernova explosions, so it's some unique type of system. We don't exactly know what it is, but it's a massive star. Okay, so we've known that for more than a decade. The other question is short GRB, so what do we know about them? Well, the first afterglows from short GRBs were discovered in 2005, so 7 years ago, and they give us the first kind of pieces of information. So we know the durations are somewhere between 0.01 and 1 second. They have no supernova associations. Okay. They come from a mix of galaxies, so they occur in galaxies that have ongoing star formation, galaxies that are essentially what's called red and dead galaxies, elliptical galaxies with no star formation. Their local environments, so the environment around the progenitor, is fairly low density, maybe of order 10 to the minus 2 particles per cubic centimeter. For long GRBs, that number is greater than 1, maybe 10. And so all of these taken together suggest that the progenitors are not massive stars. Okay, so they're not massive stars, so what? But what's attractive about these systems is the very short duration. It's well matched to the dynamical time scale that Lars just mentioned for a neutron star binary merger. And so this has been a very a favorite model in the literature for what's causing these short GRBs, neutron star binary mergers, which is great because those are the sources that LIGO is supposed to find. What else do we know about these sources? Their energy scale, corrected for beaming, is somewhere between 10 to the 49, maybe 10 to the 50 ergs. Their opening angles are of order 10 degrees. Okay. So the question is, oh, and the rate. The rate is another important part. So the detected rate is about 10 per gigaparsec cube per year. But if we correct it for the beaming, which is a correction of order a factor of 30, maybe up to 100, and we ask what's the rate within the LIGO volume, the inferred rate, it's about 10 to 30 per year. So this is very close to what we anticipate the neutron star binary merger rate will be. Of course, remember the number I gave you for that was 0.4 to 400, so it's nicely in the middle of the range, but maybe it doesn't mean much. But this is quite promising if the progenitors really are neutron star binaries. That means the rate that LIGO should detect is fairly appreciable. It's not at the low end of the distribution, which is good.
And we expect to observe only one or two ping associations here. Is that right?
Because of the beaming. Yes, I'll come back to that at the end. Yeah. Okay, so I told you they're not massive stars, but the question is, do we have any evidence that they're actually these neutron star binary mergers? And there are several pieces of evidence. I'll give you one that I think is kind of the most convincing or the most interesting. And that has to do with looking at the environments of these sources. Okay, so one expectation of the neutron star binary model is that the supernova explosions that produce the neutron stars should give those systems a systemic velocity. Okay, so if the supernova explosions are asymmetric, the system will gain some velocity through space. And those velocities can be anywhere from, let's say, 10 to 100, or maybe even hundreds of kilometers per second. Now, there's also a time scale, which is the time scale from the formation of the system until the merger actually takes place. And that time scale can be anywhere from, let's say, 10 million years to 10 giga years. 10 years. So if we put these two together and we ask where should they be located at the time of merger, well, if the velocities are low and or the time scales are very short, they will not move very far. So I'll call that distance, I'll call it the offset. Okay? So this is the offset from the birth site of the system. It can be anywhere from about zero to the other extreme where the velocities are fairly large and the merger time scales are fairly long. That can be potentially a megaparsec. Okay, so these systems can actually travel large distances or short distances. Of course, to travel such a large distance, it will have to become unbound from the galaxy, and this will require velocities probably of a few hundred kilometers per second. Even if it doesn't get unbound, it can reach large tens of kiloparsecs. Okay, so why am I telling you this? Well, this is a very clear prediction that's fairly unique to this progenitor system, and any other progenitor that we can think about for these short GRBs should not have these offsets, should be centered around zero offset. Okay, so we've been studying short GRBs for the past 7 years. We have quite a few of them that are localized very accurately, and we can go and ask how far away they are from their galaxies. Right? And so what we find is that in 3/4 of the cases of these short GRBs, the offset is about 1 to 10 kiloparsecs. Okay, so that's fairly small. It doesn't necessarily indicate that there are any kicks happening, because this is the distance from the center of the galaxy. Of course, the binary wasn't necessarily born at the center of the galaxy. So that's 3/4 of the cases consistent with zero. But then we have another 1/4 of the cases where there are no, when we go and look, even with the Hubble Space Telescope, there is no galaxy at the position of the object. Okay, so these are the ones, I'll call these hostless short GRBs. And those potentially have very large offsets. So they could have traveled very large distance away from the galaxy that produced them, which is why we don't see a galaxy at the position of the event itself. So the way we assess this is we take our images, we take the position of the afterglow over here, and we look for all the galaxies. And every time we see a galaxy, so we go out some distance, we see, here's my version of a spiral galaxy. Okay, and we ask, what is the probability that this galaxy is here just by chance? So if I take an image of the sky, I see some galaxy at that distance and of that brightness. And that probability depends on the product of the distance and brightness. Right? The further away I go, the larger area I'm searching. And the fainter the galaxy is, the more of them there are on the sky. Okay, so we have some probability, the probability of chance coincidence, which is the product of the area of the circle times the number density of galaxies of a given brightness, or brighter. Okay? Now, if I go out to this galaxy and I find that the probability of chance coincidence is tens of percent or 100%, then I say, well, it's just there by chance. It has nothing to do with the GRB. But what we actually find in reality for all of these cases is that we do this search for all the galaxies in the field, and we always find one galaxy that's at a separation of somewhere between, so offset of somewhere between 30 and 100 kiloparsecs, that has a probability of chance coincidence of less than 1%. And in some cases, much less than 1%. So what is this telling us? It's telling us that these fields, for some reason, have galaxies that should not be there by accident at the locations separate at the separations from the short gamma ray bursts. And that gives us fairly strong evidence that these are those systems, the ones that have traveled large distances from their host galaxies. So the galaxy is still there, just not at the same position, but we can still make that association despite the distance that it's traveled.
Yeah. Is it helpful to know the distance to those galaxies which are in the field of view, even approximately, in order to get a better idea about what the chance coincidence is?
Yeah, so even if you have, so the positions, the accuracies that we have here are much, much better than these distances that we're talking about.
No, I mean the distance to the...
You mean the radial distance, the redshift that he's got?
To the merger, because gravitational wave observations can give you
at the 10, 20% level, that would be good enough.
Yeah, so that's if you have a gravitational wave detection already, and it will tell you that you're within this limited volume of 200 megaparsecs. Of course, when we do these searches for short GRBs, we have no a priori limit on the distance.
That's right.
So we don't take the redshift of the galaxy into account as an additional constraint. What's interesting is what we find for these galaxies that they actually have similar redshifts to the other host galaxies of short GRB. So that gives us actually some level of confidence that the association is correct. Okay, so that's one important piece of evidence, I think, associating short GRBs with neutron star binary mergers. Of course, the ultimate direct test is we want to see one of these at the same time that we see a gravitational wave source. So that will be the nail in the coffin. How much time do I have? 10 minutes? Okay, good. Okay, so that's our short GRBs. Okay, so now I'm going to combine what I told you, given that we think this association between short GRBs and neutron star binaries is reasonably safe. We can take numbers like things, like the energy scale, the density, the opening angles, and actually use them as constraints on what the electromagnetic counterparts will look like. In particular, what's interesting is the density, right? Because the density that we infer here is the density that the jet interacted with, but it's also this density over here. It's not that the environment is completely different in different directions. So even though we've only looked at this relativistic jet and know something about the density, we can actually apply this to the interaction between this dynamical ejecta and the interstellar medium to predict the brightness of the radio emission that will result. Okay, so let me finish by bringing this together along with the other components, which were the different observational facilities and their capabilities, and all these different types of processes, to discuss what are the advantages or disadvantages of different electromagnetic counterparts and what numbers we expect. So I'll start with the easiest one, which is the relativistic jet part, since I already talked about the gamma ray burst that's resulting from that. Okay, so one possibility is that we have a gravitational wave detection plus one of these short GRBs. Okay, so this scenario has several advantages. First, actually, if we have a very accurate timestamp for the gamma ray burst, remember the duration is very short, we only have to search a small chunk of the gravitational wave data to see the coincident signal. And we also expect these systems to be the ones where the merger occurred face on, right? Because the jet will come out of the board facing the detectors, and the plane of the binary will be on the sky. Those systems are optimally oriented for detection, and the fact that we're only searching a small chunk of data means that such a coincident detection could actually boost the distance to which we can detect these sources. So instead of only 200 megaparsecs, maybe we can go to 500. So that's one advantage of this joint detection of a short GRB and a gravitational wave source. It could actually boost our ability to detect the gravitational waves. So that's one advantage. The other one, the association is unambiguous. Remember, the gamma ray sky is bright, is very dim for transients. We already know what the short GRB looks like. We know what the gravitational wave signal should look like. We see them exactly at the same time. This will make the association unambiguous. Okay, so that's another advantage. Again, because we're looking down the barrel of the jet in this case, then all of this other associated emission, the afterglow in X-rays, optical, and radio will also be bright because we're looking at a relativistic jet. So not only is the gamma ray emission going to be bright, but all the other components, X-ray, optical, radio, will be bright as well. Gamma ray satellites have a very wide field of view, so in principle it should be fairly straightforward to make a joint detection between the two, between gamma rays and gravitational waves. And as I mentioned here, we will actually prove this connection between short GRBs and neutron star binaries once and for all, rather than some of the kind of more indirect evidence that I discussed. Okay, so this will prove this equality. Okay, so those are quite a few advantages. What are the disadvantages? So as was already mentioned, this is a rare occurrence. Right? The majority of the time, we will be looking at this merger from a different angle, where the jet is not pointed at us. It's rare enough that we can estimate that perhaps this will be a once a year to once every few years joint detection. So if we want a counterpart that will be there every single time we have a gravitational wave detection, this is not what we're going to be looking for. And another part that I mentioned earlier is that gamma ray positions can be just as poor as the gravitational wave positions, so it might not actually improve the positional accuracy. Okay, so we pay the price for all of these beautiful advantages with these quite devastating, I think, disadvantages.
Current for LIGO 1, what is that number, the first one? It's still 500 megaparsec?
Oh, it was about 200. So it boosts the distance by about a factor of 2.5 or so.
Is the idea to do this in real time, so to speak, or do you correlate the data?
It can be done either way. I think the idea is to do it in real time, primarily for this point. Because if we can make that association in real time, then we can immediately go and search for these other components. So it will be delayed by minutes to hours to days, but we don't want to do it a year later, because we'll miss out on all this action. But if there was no other choice, we can do it a year later. We can take one catalog and the other catalog and kind of correlate them.
But you don't make a gravitational wave detection, send out some notices.
That is the plan. The plan is to send out those notices in effectively real time. Limited only by politics.
Well, but so at 500 megaparsecs, where most of these would be, the gravitational wave detection is not going to be statistically significant unless there is gamma ray detection.
That's right. So for this aspect of improving the position, the trigger will actually be the gamma rays, telling the LIGO people, go look at the data on this particular little time stretch to look for the signal. Okay, so a second possibility. So let's imagine that we're just slightly off axis, enough that we don't see the gamma rays, but we can still see the afterglow. So this is so this will be a detection of gravitational waves plus an off axis short GRB. So here we can actually use the information that we have on gamma ray bursts where we're looking on axis to predict what they would look like off axis. Okay, so here, of course, there's no gamma rays, but there is an afterglow. And based on this comparison from the on-axis emission, what we find is that this is detectable, this afterglow will be detectable out to an observer angle that's about twice the opening angle of the jet. Okay, so instead of having to be within this 10-degree jet, maybe we can go out to 20 degrees and still detect this. But this is still not going to be every single case, so that's maybe a 10% detection rate, where we're within twice the opening angle of the jet. Now, that statement is actually wavelength dependent. So in the optical, that's true. In the radio, we can eventually see this from any angle. And the reason is that the emission shifts into the radio part of the spectrum around the same time that this jet slows down and expands and becomes mostly spherical. So even though it started collimated, by the time it produces radio emission, it's more or less a spherical source. And so we can see it in the radio from any angle. And now the question is, how long is this going to take, and how bright is it going to be? And let me just give you these scales, because they're, I think, quite interesting. So the time scale is 1 month for an energy of 10 to the 49 ergs to the 1/3. A density of 1 particle per cubic centimeter to the minus 1/3, and the velocity, beta, to the minus 5/3. So if we have this jet, by the time it expands, beta is still around 1. It's mildly relativistic. The energy of GRB is about 10 to the 49 ergs. The density is around 10 to the minus 2. So this time scale is a few months. Okay, so this will happen a few months after. Now, the same time scale is relevant for this dynamical ejecta interacting with the medium. It's the same process, so just an outflow interacting with the medium and producing a shock. Only here, the velocity is 0.15c. The energy is 10 to the 51. It's higher. And the density is the same. So you can see what happens is the velocity goes down, the energy goes up, and that time scale gets stretched out. And what it gets stretched out to is about a decade. Okay, so what this is doing.
If you get lucky and it's on the order of a month, how long does it last once it begins to grow?
So the decline rate from that point is some sort of a power law, let's say t to the minus 1. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it will fade by a factor of 2 within a factor of 2 in time, by a factor of 10.
So you need to really watch out.
Yeah, so you need to find it, and then the time scale for it to decline is correlated to the time scale in which it shows, in which it appears. So if it appears earlier, it will evolve faster. You can see the challenge here. If it takes about a decade to for the outflow to decelerate, that means that it will take another decade to just vary in brightness by a factor of 2. So do we call this a transient? I'm not so sure, right? I mean, it challenges our observational capabilities. Okay, and then the brightness. So just the observed brightness is, I'm scaling it to a unit that I don't necessarily want you to understand, 0.3 millijoules, but this is roughly the detection limit of existing radio facilities, okay, in the gigahertz regime. And that's times the energy in units of 49, density and velocity squared. So again, for beta of 1, we're talking about and density of 0.01, we're talking about 0.01 to 0.3. And then for this slower dynamical outflow, it will be something like 0.01, maybe 0.5. Okay, because the energy is larger, but the velocity is lower, they're more or less compensated. So this is at the very threshold of our ability to detect in the radio and on a wide range of time scales. So this is going to be quite a challenging enterprise, even though this signal is visible from any angle. Which is the advantage of this approach. Okay, let me just finish by talking about the very last point, which is the gravitational wave plus a kilonova. So remember, this is this counterpart that's produced by the radioactive decay of these R-process elements. It's independent of the environment, and it's spherical. In principle, it has all the advantages that we want. And the predicted signal, which was supposed to be in the optical, is actually detectable with large field of view optical facilities. So this is detectable with LSST, and maybe even smaller telescopes. So that's fantastic. We have something that's detectable. It can be seen from any angle. It's independent of where the merger takes place, what kind of environment. The only wrinkle in this is that there are recent calculations. So the initial predictions assume that the opacity of these R-process elements, their suppression of light, is similar to iron peak elements, which suppress the light below about 0.3 or 0.4 micron. Not a big deal. We can still see them in the optical. But there are now new calculations showing that that opacity actually extends into the infrared regime around 1 micron. And remember, I mentioned earlier, and that was the reason I mentioned it, that infrared facilities do not have wide field of view. Making these searches much more difficult, and also that just the background of the bright sky actually makes the detection of faint sources very challenging. So this will either be there, if these calculations are wrong, then it will be detectable and it should be there every single time. If the new opacities are correct, it will be there every single time, and we will probably be unable to detect it, unless we're lucky.
Did anyone try to detect these things following up the STRVs?
Yes, and most of the short GRBs are too far away for us to see this signal. So we have limits, but they're not really constraining. Okay, so I'll just finish with a message that there are many reasons to look for the electromagnetic counterparts of these gravitational wave sources. It's going to be a really exciting search, but as I've shown you, it's not going to be easy. Thank you.
So, you know, regarding the short gamma ray bursts that we no host associated found, what about, I mean, is there any obvious differences in the electromagnetic properties of that sample respect to the bulk of the population?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And so one key difference that we've noticed is that their afterglow emission is fainter than the other ones, and we think that that's a reflection of the fact that they're happening in a lower density medium because they are taking place 50 kiloparsecs away from the center of the galaxy. So their environment is even more tenuous than a normal short GRB, suppressing the brightness of the afterglow.
And what about the host galaxies for the 75% of the Schrödinger remnants and the one which are suspected to be the host galaxies?
They're in essentially every parameter, they're similar.
Right.
And their star formation rates, masses, metallicities, redshifts.
Nice. Yeah.
So Jim, to answer your political question, LIGO has decided that the first four alerts will be maintained as in-house through collaboration. Only those astronomers who sign an LOU will have access.
Well, yeah, I had another question. How enthusiastic are the people that own these other telescopes? I mean, these other wavelength regions are about doing this. They regard it as a great thing.
That's a very complicated question for two reasons. Yeah. One is that some people are enthusiastic, but those are not necessarily the same people that have control over the telescope. The other one is that it's not obvious who actually has control of some of these facilities, right? Because some of these are national facilities that are managed by organizations like the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. They manage the facility, but they don't own it. And so somebody has to come in and say, this is the science I want to do. I want you to give me half of all the time for a decade, and then I'll go and look for these sources. And maybe you can convince them, or maybe not. But, you know, on the other hand, on the gamma ray side, it will be fairly straightforward, because these satellites are detecting them anyway. There's no cost associated with it. Same for LSST, the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. The telescope was built for a certain reason. It wasn't built to do this. And so you might have to disrupt their normal operations in order to use the telescope as a follow-up instrument. LIGO, and if it gets to the point where that follow-up takes up 100% of the time, they will not be happy.
Thanks.